format changes slightly for the last session. Don, I think they want to wire us up on stage, apparently. So, and we're speaking from there.
That's right.
And while Tobias mics up our next two speakers, I'll just take this opportunity of saying a few words about Rosie. Rosie has already introduced Donna, our final speaker of the day. Rosie herself is Distinguished Professor in the Humanities at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. She has published extensively in feminist philosophy, epistemology, post-structuralism, psychoanalysis. Her books cover a wide range of topics. There was Patterns of Dissonance, published by Polity Press in 91, goes on to Nomadic Subjects, Embodiment and Sexual Difference in Contemporary Feminist Theory, Metamorphoses Towards a Materialist Theory of Becoming, and she has also edited and co-edited numerous books in this area. She has also given London a real kind of kick with her presence here over the last year as a Leverhulme professor, and I'm really, really chuffed that she's here this afternoon at the end of this professorship. So welcome Rosie Bredossi and Donna Haraway, please.
Thank you very much. We want to stay in this sort of mood. I think it's the afternoon is progressing where we want, in the direction that we were hoping it would move towards. So the idea is that we share this session and we speak for shorter periods, and then we try to dialogue or do something, sing along. Our DJ has returned, so I take it that the mixing of the sound bites is going very well. I would like to make 3.5 points and then pass the ball on to Donna. The first 1.5 point concerns a sort of a summary of why really we wanted to get into this mode, the mood that we are going towards, about ways of dying and ways of experimenting with public discourses, public practices of dealing with different, multiple, complex ways of dying. I think Iona's final remarks that maybe pain and suffering should be disjointed, that we need a relationship to pain that is not necessarily indexed on negativity, on something that we would want to avoid, suffering. I think that could be a common denominator between my paper and what Donna, I think, is going to do in hers. The starting point of this discourse was straight political theory. We started with our colleagues at the Burbeck School looking at how discourses about power over life, biopolitics, biopower, really are discourses about the government of the dying and death. You cannot really have one without the other. Certainly not in an era such as ours, an era of advanced biotechnologies, in an era people call, and it's quite a mouthful, biogenetic capitalism, where the politics of life itself, to quote Nick Rose, is really at the heart of the meta. And if it is an era where the triumph of biogenetic capitalism functions under the double helix of historical and biological determinism, Fukuyama's end of history and Dawkins' selfish gene, if this is the biopolitical era that we are going in, then, that we're living in, then necropolitics, the politics of dying, is simply another way of getting to the problem. And we wanted to look at the problem of biopolitics, bios, the management of living, from this other angle, because we think, and I don't know who the we is at this point, certainly I think, I and my favorite philosopher think, that we have kind of complexified, multi-layered, we have looked at bios from a variety of angles, but the necros part, the death part, has not been looked at. And yet, death is immensely familiar, ubiquitous, and terribly, terribly present in our social existence. It certainly is in our media and telecommunication and news, where we're surrounded by sort of death counts and body counts on a daily basis. How is the war doing today, how are the multiple wars going today. There is a kind of a familiarity with corpses of all kinds that makes them borderline invisible, so familiar are we with them. There is a peculiar proximity of the practices, certainly of death by killing, that makes them strangely unspeakable. So there is also a tremendous familiarity of practices of diseases and loss and various epidemics of all kinds, cancer being one, but there are many others, TB, malaria, and anorexia, bulimia, youth suicide, and depression, burnout, various forms of epidemics that make the experience of loss, again, very familiar, very close, and practically invisible. So what I wanted to do through Ways of Dying was to force us to look at a deficit in our systems of representation, theoretical representation, as well as cultural representation, that would bring us closer to what we experience as multiple, many ways of dying. Now, the important thing about looking at bios from the angle of ways of dying, biopower from the angle of death, is that immediately you get a transversality effect, that what dies, what is being lost, what is being mourned, the pain of the loss, does not only latch on to human actors, but to many other forms of living and sort of life matter that is being lost, that is being dead, or is in the process of being lost. There is a non-human element to processes of dying that is being reported by many of the social critics that are trying to look at biopower seriously. When Vandana Shiva talks about biopiracy, and when she says we are losing tot number of seeds of plants on a yearly basis. There used to be 57 varieties of carrots, what do I know? Apples, well, we are down to what Monsanto and the great big corporate companies have decided should be the seeds and the living plants for this season. There is a real biopiracy, so a selection of bioorganism that really covers the whole of what we used to call nature. And that forces us to look at ways of dying in a far more transversal, non-human manner. I want to be very, very careful with this human, non-human, not only because I'm sitting next to Donna Haraway, who is the great thinker of the post-human, although she would have problems with that label, I'm sure, and that's for our conversation as well. But as the thinker who has conceptualized cyborgs and companion species and multiple other levels of transversal connections, the non-human is a little bit an area that Donna Haraway is probably more familiar with than most of us. For social critics and certainly for philosophers, the non-human, which I in my work describe as Zoe, the relentless energy of creative life and creative organisms, in a firm but polite disagreement with Agamben. Agamben predicates Zoe on the horizon of mortality, on the predictable sort of extreme vulnerability of the humanoid. The Zoe, the bare life in you, is that which sovereign power can terminate and exterminate at will. Well, I prefer to do Zoe with Nietzsche, with Deleuze, and look at it affirmatively as there's absolutely a relentless generative force. This life in you that does not bear your name and carries on regardless, and regardless of, for instance, individual death being just a blink on a machine, of what could be called neo-vitalist sort of processes or neo-vitalist conceptions of life as Zoe. And this is a very big one, looking at Zoe as the non-human and as the relentless generative. This creates problem for the social philosopher, the social thinkers. It's not a very simple concept. It's not a very welcome concept. Vitalism is complicated historically, conceptually, and the moment you start talking about transversal connections, interspecies connections, and generative forces, and you do get sort of frowned upon as either some sort of strange new age individual or as somebody who is tempted by spirituality, as if being tempted by spirituality and were some sort of jump into the deep end of radical stupidity. Or even worse, as if going with Zoe, going with a life that is relentless to the point of redefining processes of dying, as if doing that were a form of moral anarchy, or even worse, downright immorality. And the philosophical forum where this discussion is taking place is the reception of Foucault's work and mostly the second Foucault, the Foucault of the self-styling of one's life, the Foucault that actually, particularly in the rereading operated by Rose and Rabineau, suffers from overdoses of residual Kantianism, the Foucault that is strangely accountable in some predictable ways that contradict, I think, his vision of power and his vision of absolute and raw energy at the core of the subject. So these are the three and three almost a quarter points. This is the context within which the punchline that we wanted to get to is how can we fill in this conceptual and cultural deficit? How can we find ways of talking about the political economy of dying in a culture that is simultaneously bathing in necropolitics and denying it, denying its presence and its relevance? And maybe the way that I could make this very concrete is looking at the political economy of affects in our culture, and the kind of affects that we are all plunged in socially, in the kind of images, representations, and modes of interaction that are offered to us. It seems to me that we are now living in a militarized social space under the clash of civilization and under the pressure of increased enforcement of security, escalating states of emergency. It's a state of permanent fear. Everybody's talking about this, but the psychic, affective, and moral effects of this maybe haven't been measured enough. The Cold War doctrine of mutually agreed destruction, called MAD, has mutated into the global notion of self-assured destruction, SAD. Nuclear paranoia has given way to viral politics and the need for total coverage to be insured against the accident, which is of course going to happen. It is only a question of time. The fear for the imminent catastrophe, which is absolutely certain, it is only a matter of time, is definitional of our days. And as usual, the Tate, being the greatest art museum in the world, gets it right. There's a lovely graffiti in the members' room of the Tate that, in my opinion, just sort of traces the shift from MAD to SAD, from nuclear time paranoia to global time fear of the catastrophe. And the graffiti says, after Cold War, global warming. Just a question of time. So in this context, it seems to me that political activism was replaced, certainly after September 11, by collective public rituals of mourning. We have really plunged into what I would call a dominant ideology of mourning and melancholia, and I would really stress the ideology part of that. The only public discourse we have to deal with the political economy of negativity, of affects, of fear, is melancholia. It is absolutely a dominant way to go about it, and it does go together with a certain return of God or a suspension of secularism. What I would like to try to do, while respecting both the political economy of the affects and the sense of loss, of fear, the vulnerabilities that motivate this discourse, I would like to try a different take on it. I would like to try to look at some sort of ethics of affirmation, maybe working from that disjunction between pain and suffering that I think is one of Iona's strongest conclusions in her paper. So I could put my concluding 3.5, and this is the half part, remark as a question. Given the ubiquitous presence of necropolitics in our social and cultural sphere, can we propose ways of reworking our relationship to processes of mourning in such a way that they allow to have compassion and respect for the hurt and wound, but to work it through to an ethics of affirmation? And what could that ethics of affirmation look like? And that's where Donna comes in.
Rosie and I have a very different kind of a tone in our two presentations that is a deliberate kind of enactment of what we think of as our friendship. We titled this Transposed Companions because we keep looping through each other, kind of transing and taking up positions that feel a bit other than those we were born with, kind of transgenic in our friendships, that we are transposed companions on a number of levels. And I think that will show up in these two meditations that open up a conversation by a kind of the kind of sweep that Rosie has given us that ends with an inquiry about how one might move through and with pain and suffering, which are not the same thing, to activating some kind of relationship to the surplus, massive killing and death that we are living within, not of the kind that Iona was talking about, not the kind of ordinary dying to which every mortal creature is not only subject, but in a kind of embrace that makes us possible in the first place, but that kind of extraordinary, massive surplus, exceptional murder. Whether one is, I'm particularly aware of that in the more than human world, both as Vandana Shiva is in relationship to the plant world and its genetic diversity and the ways of life built into that diversity, but in relationship to the meat industrial complex and its apparatuses, and the exterminist ideology of what I think of as the animal rights response to that, that the only possible response to that is the wiping out of the working relationship between human beings and food and fiber animals, for example. That there is no way to imagine a moving through work and labor and pain and killing and living and eating and dying that is ordinary in these worlds of exterminism, even on the part of those who would speak for the exterminated. These appeals to rights that I regard as really, in a very fundamental way, often quite exterminist in their relationship to working beings, including plants, animals, and human beings. So that an affirmative ethics of pain is not an optimistic ethics. Rosie speaks of an affirmative ethics. But it is one that tries to come to terms with the interdependencies of mortal creatures. And that, then, is where I will pick up my reading on an intensely personal note. I have been writing, as you have been forewarned, about human-animal relationships, but that is not actually what I'm going to be speaking about in my note of a sports writer's daughter, but rather I'm going to be speaking about a man and two wheelchairs interposed with a pair of crutches, the wheelchair of youth, the wheelchair of dying, and the crutches of an adult life. And I'm going to talk about the process of my father, my father's living and dying. He was a sports writer, as you will learn. And this talk is a note of a sports writer's daughter. It is writing that I must do because it is about a legacy, an inheritance in the flesh. To come to accept the body's unmaking, I need to remember its becoming. I need to recognize, to recognize all the members, animate and inanimate, that make up the knot of a particular life, my father, Frank Outen Haraway's life. Now, my husband, partner Rustin, and I have been privileged to accompany our aging parents in the last months and years of their lives. A year ago, my brothers and I held my father while he died. Alert and present, and after a day of sharing family videos and talking with his hospice care doctor and having the great good luck of a community of co-workers and family, which didn't mean that the last part was without pain, of the most literal physical kind, as well as other sorts. But we held him in the process of his no longer being there. Now, this was not simply a process of his no longer being present as a soul, or an interiority, or a mind, or a subject. His body, as his body cooled, his body was no longer there. The corpse is not the body. It is something else that deserves its own processes. The body is always in the making. It is in the grip of Zoe. It is always a vital entanglement of heterogeneous scales, times, and kinds of being webbed into fleshly presence, always a becoming, always constituted in relating. Now, mine is a looping set of stories of the generations. It is a story about inheriting the craft of writing looping braided stories, stories of the game. Born in 1916, my father was a sports writer for the Denver Post for 44 years. After retiring from the paper in 1981, he continued to work in the Denver sports world as the baseball official scorer for the National League Colorado Rockies and as part of the statistics crew for the Denver Nuggets basketball and Broncos football. His last working game was in September of 2004 when he was 87 years old. Writing his own epitaph, he lived and died as a sports writer, or as he put it, a fan who got paid to do what he loved. Now, from a community that regards special sports as the incarnation of the devil, the academic community that thinks Catholics are sheep and pro sports people are, you know, tools of capital, I introduce this sports writer's daughter with a certain kind of bite that makes me particularly love the remark of the soccer, of the football, the man of football. It's much more important than that. Which isn't to say for a minute it is the tool of corporate capital and much else that is much worse than that. Now, I try to be something of a sportswoman, about here, which you will hear a little at the very end. In the university, I too am lucky enough to be paid to do what I love. So I write about the inheritance of being a journalist's daughter, a sports writer's daughter, about my effort to gain the father's regard, not the father's gaze, but that regard of holding in mutual esteem, that ricocheting specularity of respecere, of respect, that is the holding in mutual regard, that is the exact opposite of what I think most critical theory has learned to theorize best, which might be figured in the gaze of incest, a gaze that I was lucky not to have to cope with, but I know something of the damage that it does and something of the way that no family in a regime of compulsory heterosexual reproduction can fully escape. Now, I am more or less a heterosexual daughter of a relentlessly heterosexual father, a girl child who never had her father's heterosexual gaze. His was a deliberate withholding of that gaze, I now believe, and I both loathed and envied his gender conventional sexualization of other girls and women, wondering, why not me? He. Yeah, you laugh, huh? But I got my father's regard in another matter, another way, a life-given bodily way. I believe I got his respect. Now, consider regard and respect a little longer. I've already said something about the tones of this kind of looking at, active regard, respectus, respecere, to take heed, to take care of, to have care for. Now, I have written lately particularly about companion species, by which I do not mean small children in fur coats. Nor do I mean the important but rather small category of companion animals, which will, of course, include soft-shelled turtles rescued from bad pet stores, pot-bellied pigs, cats, dogs of various ages. I understand companion animals to be a very serious and indeed very large and historically quite recent and very interesting category. But that's not what I mean by companion species. By companion, I mean to be messmates together at table, somehow to be in the relationship of eating together, perhaps even eating each other and getting indigestion, kind of not altogether sure who is predator and who prey and what sorts of indigestion might be conducive to multi-species co-flourishing and what sorts of indigestion should be relieved by antacids. I'm extremely interested in companion companus, in this relationality that I believe is about being finite, mortal, and involved in eating on this earth. Now, species is a similar kind of word that is about the question of kind. It opens up an interrogative relationship to the question of logical type, the visual impression on a wax tablet, to the goodness of money. Is the monarch's image real or counterfeit? Is the metal adulterated, a wonderful word, or not? Is specie good? Is gold glittering or is it shit? Species is the Eucharist, the real presence under bread and wine. It's science fiction aliens. It's the human race. It's a Darwinian sort of thing. Species is all of that. All the important words contain oxymoronically their murmuring minis. They aren't necessarily, not only the opposites, but that crowd of non-self, of difference, that crowd of non-self identity that really mortal critters really are, that never being self-identical, that all that is really here is a multi-species interdependency, which is why I refuse the label of post-humanist, The same reasons, basically, I refuse the label of post-feminist. There's still wonderful and important work to be done under the label of humanism as well as feminism. And in any case, it doesn't. The post-going postal does not get at least not verbally, much of the theory actually does, but verbally it doesn't insist on the multi-species relationality that we all are. We are all a crowd, not in the sense of some kind of massified, oppressed mess, but in a kind of multi-species interrelationality that we barely understand. Now, when my father was 16 months old, he fell. And bone tuberculosis was the result. That's the family story. I think he already had bone tuberculosis, and that's why he fell in the particular way he did. But the shiny floor was blamed. And the trauma of a very painful and untreatable disease, he was born in 1916, set in the toddler that was very frightening to everybody concerned. The diagnosis was very uncertain. But he spontaneously healed, it remitted. But he fell again when he was 5, and it no longer remitted, and began a series of many years of bone tuberculosis, beginning in the hips and moving down the legs and the knees, and resulting in intense and unremitted and untreatable childhood pain that put him in a full-length body cast for 3 of those years. And because his father was a sports promoter and an owner of Piggly Wiggly grocery stores and brought Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig to Denver, who signed my father's baseball in his bed, and so forth. Since my father's father had a little money, my father was privileged to have home tutoring and a wheelchair out at the old Merchants Park, where my grandfather would have him carried and install him in the wheelchair of his youth when he was able to get out of bed, and watch the games and paid for baseball equipment for the neighborhood kids. So if I could have the first slide. There, perhaps. Yeah. My father was known as a good baseball player, at least a popular one, maybe only because his father bought the uniforms and the bats and the balls, although I like to think that my father's gap-toothed smile was part of the reason. The Lou Gehrig Babe Ruth baseball involves another set of wonderful stories, because the ball the kids were playing with, the last out of the 9th inning, the ball fell apart once and for all and died and was truly unusable, and the kids talked Dad into getting his Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig autographed baseball, and Dad thought, what the hell, one out, what could happen to my ball? Of course, it was hit beyond the fielder's glove and rolled down the gutter of the urban street and into the sewer, where it still fertilizes family stories. It has the kind of narrative afterlife as the never again seen ball signed by the greats, by the immortals of the sport. He got a wheelchair when he was about 13 and went to school outside the home for the first time, and then got crutches when he was 17 and galloped off to Denver University, where he was the sports writer for the Denver Clarion, and basically hung out with the sports figures really all his life, from the time he was a small kid, prompting my first husband, who was totally gay, but so oversexed that he even fell in love with a woman. a dear friend, we could never quite sort it out. We didn't know who would get the sewing machine and who would get the camera. So we just added on our supposedly sex-appropriate lovers and made a bigger family and never did it right. My father had a terrible time sorting this out, but had a kind of, well, Donnie, if you're doing it, it must be all right. I always thought that maybe you'd marry somebody who could support you, but apparently not. Anyway, we know you could have been a real doctor, but nonetheless, he coped. My fully, seriously gay husband asked my father repeatedly what it was like to constantly whack the bums of football players in the locker room. And my father had no idea how to answer questions of that sort, and would smile and pass the gravy. Or he once told me that Jay had this man has the most amazing sense of humor. The baseball stories, the questions he asked about baseball were so funny. And I said that they weren't funny. He actually doesn't know anything at all about baseball. Truly nothing. These were not jokes. Anyway, you got the point.
in the freshman year, the other guys on the football team set up a track meet between a fellow, a football player who had broken his ankle and was temporarily on crutches, and they get the starting gun from the track team, and they set it up, and Dad takes off in his crutches and wins, crosses the finish line, looks back, the guy has fallen and broken his other leg. The coach warns Dad off the track, if you ever engage any of my athletes in one of these fiascos again, you can, forget hanging around with a football team, sports writer, whatever. If I could have the second slide. I remember as a small girl what it was like to have a father who had totally rigid hips and only partially mobile knees, though you see the kickback. He had no stride. He had no plane of motion of any kind in the hips. And never for a minute was there any sense in the family that my father didn't need crutches or that the rigid hips weren't there. This was not about the denial of disability. On the other, nor was it the denial of the stories of the unrelieved pain or many other things, but it was about living well. It was about mobility. He won the Colorado State Table Tennis Championship 3 years in a row without being able to stride. I don't know if you've ever seen table tennis and the ground covered in the stride of table tennis players. That kind of guts, desire, willingness to make a fool of yourself, failure. The kind of living with the crutches, the wheelchair. Now, my brothers and I, of course, would run off with Dad's crutches all the time and see how we did on them. This was normal behavior. Both of my brothers, neither of whom had any disorder of the hips of any kind, walked exactly like my father, with precisely the same kind of odd stigmata. It was only a hint, but it was there. It was extremely interesting, my father-son mimesis. That was written into the flesh and was the story of family jokes. This picture was taken, Dad didn't know it was being taken. He was a sports writer. He was at the baseball games before the games, hanging out in the third base side, watching batting practice, just kind of hanging out. One must say literally hanging out, utterly airborne. And continued to work for many years. And then he fell and he broke his hip. As he moved into his 80s, the crutches were more and more necessary for moving around at all in the house or any other place. And mobility became more and more problematic and falling more and more likely. And there were several falls that didn't quite add up to major trouble. And then, of course, the fall that broke the hip. And the return, because there was so much calcification in the hip joints and so much scarring, there was no way to use an internal pin and no way to stabilize with an external device, and really no good way to deal with stabilization, which really meant the physical therapy was a bit of a joke in terms of standing again, much less walking, and the pain was pretty badly relieved during this period. That process of many months, about 9 months, of making decisions about whether to continue to work with a physical therapist or not, whether to go for more or less opiates, whether to take the craziness of regular overdosing or not, all of these very ordinary issues undertaken with staff, with friends, with medical people, with family. His thinking that we weren't ready to let him die, our thinking that he wasn't yet willing to die, our not being willing quite yet to own up to each other, that both of us thought it was time. His intense relief when he finally got it, that neither my brothers nor I felt he needed to keep doing this if he didn't feel like he needed to keep doing this. The stories of race and class and gender and sexuality and all the rest of it were there. For example, out of bed for decades, he lived those last 8 months mostly back in bed, as I said, in poorly relieved pain, learning how to be mobile without legs again. His bone-deep regard for people did not fail him. He flirted mercilessly with the nurses, Claudia and Laurie, and his massage therapist, Tracy, with the same cheerful, heterosexual self-entitlement that had plagued my feminist soul and roused my latent envy for decades, I found I was still completely vulnerable to this amazing practice. He also formed gentle, trusting bonds with male caretakers, John, the blonde Denver kid, and Lucky, the black immigrant from Ghana, unaided by the specular and verbal devices of flirtations and across the gulfs of race, class, and intimate bodily dependency. I thought the women who cared for him became his friends in spite of and not because of his flirting. They knew another kind of regard was also operating even more powerfully, if less articulately. And they still call my family, the men and the women call, to see how we are doing. Now, in the last months, he got a talented cyborg wheelchair that was radically different from the 1920s chariot I see in the old photos. The ad brochure for the cyborg implanted chariot promised everything but flight. Dad developed an affectionate, joking relationship with Drew, the kind and able wheelchair salesman who perhaps oversold his device. The physical therapist, Shauna, set up orange traffic cones in a line for him in the hallway of the so-called nursing home that we called Rocky Road, so that he could, it was a Rocky Mountain something or other, we called it Rocky Road, so that he could practice navigating through the cones so as not to hit, dubiously ambulatory co-residents with his never quite trustworthy cyborg wheelchair. It didn't take us long to increase liability on his driving insurance. Semi-recumbent, he had to pass Shauna's driving test with this chip implanted overachieving chair, which he never for a minute trusted, but of which he was rather proud, even though he could not get into it and out of it on his own. Now, this chair, unlike the one you saw earlier, never became a beloved significant other, as his crutches had. This partner was overwhelmingly about loss, from which there would be no exit, except death. It was a much fancier chair than the one of his youth, but it no longer signified getting well and going to the games. This chair, this transaction between wary companion species, was about the practice of dying, and he knew it. Even so, the chair assisted his process with companions of many species, both the apparatuses and the people, in a way that continued to stimulate a sports writer's eye for the vitality of movement in the world. So he kept going for as long as he could, and then he couldn't. He got pneumonia, and he decided not to treat it. He decided not to be admitted to the hospital for further diagnosis, because he knew perfectly well what being admitted to the hospital would almost certainly entail and that he would lose control. He decided to go because in any meaningful sense, he could stay in the game no longer. The game story was filed, his sort of metaphor. Indeed, on his desk, we found a sticky with the logo of the Morning Fish Wrapper, as he called it, that is to say the rival newspaper, the Rocky Mountain News. The Morning Fish Wrapper, stuck in a plastic paper cube weight on his desk in which he had penned his epitaph, namely, "When the good Lord decides I can no longer go to the games I love so much, I just want to be remembered as a happy man who loved his family, who loved people, and as a sports fan who got paid for writing what he saw." Now, we worried for a while that we should have cremated his crutches with his remains, because they belonged together. They were one vital body, human and more than human, human and less human and non-human, less than human, human. They were one body, the man and his crutches. But instead, my younger brother took the crutches home and put them in the living room, where they became a kind of ancestor. They link us to our ancestors, those companion species and other kinds of ontic and antic time. Now, my father, as you will have guessed from his confrontation with my gay husband, not confrontation, his deep love and puzzlement. They were both very puzzled by each other. They both really could not figure out their forms of masculinity. They recognized and respected each other as men and did not have a clue. Now, my father was not a particularly self-reflective man, unlike Jay. He didn't theorize these matters. As far as I could tell, And to my shame, I never tired of trying to recast him into the mold I wanted him to fit. From praying for his conversion to Catholicism when I was a child, to trying to get him to read books and analyze everything in sight when I was an adult, none of which he would consent to do. He never wanted to be a columnist or to run the sports department of the big city newspaper. He never wanted to write the stories about the commercial, social, racial, and political apparatus that makes professional sports possible. He was not reflective about what it might take for a man of his generation and race and class to write the kinds of stories he wrote. He wanted to write the game stories, and he was very good at it. Now, I told you I never gave this man any quarter and never tired of trying to get him to recognize and indeed to recast him in the mold that only the reformist zeal of a daughter can do in dealing with this relentless white, heterosexual, big sports, this person with whom I thought I had gained some theoretical insight, you know. Now, I am playing a sport with a member of another species called agility. It's a sport you play with dogs. Your partner is a member of another species. Language is in the way. It's more like doubles tennis, where you generally aren't engaging in a deep conversation, but in some kind of choreographed, a kinesthetic reading of each other's moves in a way that somehow allows you to have a good game, a good run is what Cayenne, my partner, and I are after. We have trained together extremely hard. We play this game with other dogs and human beings. It's a game played on a field about 100 feet on a side with a bunch of diabolical obstacles, jumps and tunnels of various kinds, big 6-foot-high A-frames that the dog has to run up and run down, and cut swatches of colored paint at different points on the A-frames in order to do the rules. You run around various patterns set by the judge. The dog has never seen the field. The human being, and what we call the night of the living dead, walks the course. There are about 50 human beings paying no attention to each other, none whatsoever, except to try to get each other out of the way, walking the course, imagining running it with their partner dog, so that they can show their dog the patterns that you run at speed. In about 25 seconds, it's all over. You and your dog train quite literally for thousands of hours, trying to figure out each other's co-species biobehavioral repertoires and communicating with each other in this extraordinary way that involves the play repertoire of these two species that do read each other in co-evolutionary time but don't have the same behavioral moves, do know how to read them but need to cobble them together in different sorts of ways in what a sport is, after all, an arbitrary testing of the rules. It is a competitive international sport, and Kyan and I train to be able to play in the nationals and, in our dreams, or at least one of our dreams, win. in any case, we care a great deal about getting faster times than the greats. It's an amateur sport in which the really good teams play with the wannabes like us. I have a world-class dog with a mediocre middle-aged handler. I've seen ads in the personal columns of my newspaper, world-class dog seeks adequate handler, followed by my phone number. I've accused Cayenne of betrayal of the lowest kind. I try very hard to be worthy of this partner. My father, in unrelieved pain and overdosed on opiates, I'm showing him videos of the international competitions and showing him course outlines of the last World Cup finals and telling him that Monday Night Football will be replaced by a real sport at last. Certain that he's not getting. He would mumble fatherly things like, it's so nice that you have something to be interested in. You know, I'm so happy, you know, that you have something to, you know, and Dad, you're not getting it. I couldn't make him a Catholic. Maybe I could at least get him to let go of football and see agility, think I. Well, then in that same summer, overdosed on opiates and trying to think about when he was going to, cut them down. And he writes me, I give him a video, and to my complete astonishment, I get in the mail, because I don't live in town, I'm going back and forth every couple of weeks, I get in the mail a game story that he wrote of one of the videos of Cayenne and me playing. that with a professional game story, with the same care. He saw when we broke down. He saw the bad turn. He saw the good pattern. He saw us get it back together after we made a mistake on course. He wrote a sports story. So, said I, that's what I mean by regard. That's what I mean by that kind of father-daughter gaze, but it's not a gaze, it's respect. So, I wrote this shortly after Dad died. This was he died in the end of September, and Kyan and I ran in December and had an unusually good weekend, which is to say, four perfect runs where we beat the greats. I assure you this never happens. It will never happen again. We were stripped of two of our runs because of a mistake I made on our entry form, which I think is exactly the crack in the Celadon vase that makes the achievement. The picture that I have of Kyan that I love the most is this extraordinary tight turn of a well put together and seriously coordinated athlete after she has dropped the bar in the previous jump that shows in the picture. It's that's what the game story is about. That is what the corporate sports are not, but that's the game story, okay? So in the season of recalling miracles off 34th Street, Chris Kringle and, you know, Miracle on 34th Street for the film buffs, Chris Kringle must take a back seat to a marvel that happened closer to home. It happened to me in Cayenne in California's decidedly non-metropolitan Central Valley. Such a marvel will never happen again. Maybe I dreamed it. I hesitate to tell you in case I wake up. Maybe I'll write again later, but I must check if reality holds. Here goes. Kyan and I got four perfect qualifying scores out of four runs, the Sacramento Dog Training Club, Rancho Murrieta, Friday and Saturday. There, I said it. The sun is still shining, and so I'll tell you the rest. If the earth shakes, I'll stop. Only international competitor Sharon Freilich's Rip, among all the excellent class dogs of both A and B sections, got faster scores in three of the runs. In the jumpers with weaves on Saturday, we were 0.5 seconds behind Sharon and Rip. Oh my, now I'll wake up for sure, recklessly, I forge on. In the remaining excellent standard B course, we were fifth, behind a bunch of cheating, scruffy, big-name border collies about whom I'll say no more. Okay. I go on for a little bit. And then I say, and we were only behind Sharon and Rip, or did I mention that already? With tight turns, serious focus, weaves to use in a teaching video, and blazing times. I will not mention, although perhaps this is the reason the sun is still shining and the earth not shaking, our less than perfect start line holds. Am I happy? Is Kyan a Klingon warrior princess? Yes. How do I know? Because the sun is still shining. Note of a sports writer's daughter. That's it. It's Nietzsche. No.
Well, I don't know whether we want to wrap up with a conclusion or throw it open immediately. The point about transposed companions is this mode of relationality, the modes of relation that function in multiple complex ways, zigzagging in and out of each other's projects and zigzagging in and out of experiences and disciplinary fields. I don't think that we need to really conclude. I would prefer to throw it open and see what comes.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
I guess, thank you very much. This is a question, but there's a kind of comment in it, perhaps, but I prefer to think of it as a question. Rosie asked, what would ethics of affirmation look like? And I remained with this question in my mind to some extent. I must say a proviso first. Well, if we are there where Foucault told us we were, then we're not yet at the point of ethics of affirmation. That's at least how I'm getting to Rosie's point. Foucault talked of a type of power which is important today, which is not the power to say no, but it is the power to tell us who we are. It's a highly creative power to tell us what we have to do to measure us, to take our sizes and everything else. The resistance to this type of power is not about affirming yourself, as it used to be sometimes in the past with class struggle, for example, but it is about resisting who we are, who we are being told we are. And think, for example, of queer theory, perhaps. I don't want to get into that, but so we are not, if we're there, we're definitely not affirming who we are, if we're still at the point that Foucault was commenting upon, we're resisting being told who we are, we're resisting being identified, being put in a cage, in a way. Identity is almost a cage. And then I listened to what Professor Haraway's presentation, which was absolutely beautiful, even just how it was told, the words chosen were beautiful. But they raised a question that was certainly affirmative. I've been to the US recently. It was in a way self-affirmative. Perhaps. It's true, you talked about many members of your family, but it was very much about yourself and your family. And when I went to the US, I saw photo exhibitions and artists exhibiting their work, and a lot of it was about, can I affirm, can I test how people will react to my story? I'm not saying you've done this, but to me, there's some similarity with this self-affirmation, which I'm not sure this is the answer to the question that Rosie asked, which is, what would an ethics of affirmation look like? Because always when I was in the United States, I had another problem. And I'm going to keep it short. We passed in front of Ground Zero. And I noticed that nothing had been rebuilt. Instead, there was a long list of mourning and comments had been taken. And I thought that if we were in an ethics of affirmation, instead of attacking Iraq and doing all that followed, then perhaps the President of the United States and everybody else would have tried desperately to rebuild that in 1 month, would have challenged everybody to work as volunteers and rebuild it in the name of an ideal, not of a self, but of an ideal that could have worked both for himself and the Muslim and everybody else. But that didn't happen. Instead, there was a lot of mourning. Can we find an ethics of affirmation that is about affirming ideals that work for us and others? Or are we still, in a way, victims of a power? I mean, the reason why he didn't rebuild it was a question of political interests. I guess this is a very naive way to put my question, but I would like some reactions to these reflections from you. Thanks.
Yeah, let me say something about that. I think that the parable that Rosie brought up of the two kinds of exterminism, Cold War, Global War, and the melancholia and mourning relationship to these two kinds of the coming apocalypse, and the best one can do is melancholia, that the ethics of affirmation is about getting on together. It is about learning how to inherit the disaster in order to build a mortal, finite life that is not waiting for the apocalypse. And that the United States failed on that in its exterminist security emotional as well as military relationship to 9/11. The political affective politics of the United States in relationship to 9/11 made it almost impossible not only to rebuild a marker for getting for some kind of more livable future that might have taken the form, perhaps, of addressing the fundamental of dealing with Israel and Palestine as opposed to invading Iraq and Afghanistan, of actually addressing the completely unimaginable, actually building the still unimaginable joint future that must be lived jointly, that what Helen Varon calls getting on together, that is the politics of mortal creatures. And I couldn't agree with you more that the highly personal story that I was talking about here was about getting on together as a family and a person, and also in the terms of the questions of big time sports and competitive sports and achievement and particular racial politics of sports. All of those issues are in the question of inheritance, lived and memorialized intensely personally, and very much about what it is to be a
62-year-old daughter, but hardly an adequate politics. Or indeed, not in a certain sense, not a politics at all, but perhaps in some kind of alliance with or looking for a mode of consciousness that does not that is not about resistance. It is not about, let me tell you in how many ways I am not queer in the way you're doing identity politics. It is not about resistance, though it is about getting the disasters. I cannot look at the animal industrial complex and not get it. And my getting on together is such things as supporting the Rare Breed Trust, meat marketing, including its class politics. That is far from innocent. That's a tiny piece of a vast political, a need. I think the need for a political imagination is about getting on together and not about resistance.
It's a great question, I really do think that the reference to Foucault is a tricky one, because even in the way I put the question in my short introduction, I insinuated that Foucault may have asked the right question, even that is today to be looked at again, but certainly it doesn't provide an answer that is satisfactory. It may be the great problem of Foucault scholarship, and this is a great debate whether the second Foucault, the Foucault of the ethics, of the self-styling, the ethical relationship, is actually adequate. I happen to think not. I happen to think that, and that is why that residual Kantian reading of Foucault that we are getting today is regressive in my mind. What I think an ethic of affirmation benefits from is a process ontology, looking at relations and relationality. And that is the great point of conjunction between my work, which is vastly different, and Donna's work, from philosophy and the kind of analytics of our culture that Donna Haraway does. I think if you're looking at relational processes as opposed to a kind of a political existence that still assumes a subject in charge, if you're looking at relations, then a number of things happen. One is, of course, multi-layeredness as opposed to simple type of other ways of simply splitting the subject, and that you can split the subject, you can make a subject non-unitary in a variety of ways. Psychoanalysis does that, but it's a rather simple dichotomous split. Multi-layeredness would be very, very sort of multi-relational. We can do it with, obviously, the Deleuzean and Guattari and ecologies of self, multiple ecologies of the self, and we can do it by looking across the categories where the relations are multiple relations to human and non-human others. When we learn to think of our bodies, ourselves, our zombies, ourselves, as organisms that relate to a number of entities that empower us to exist, to survive, to get on. Oxygen is a relation, language is a relation, and sweating is a relation, and affects and emotion are a relation. The problem is, in our culture, we have a dominant vision of the subject that privileges certain sensorial perceptual apparati as the foundations of the subject. So sentiments, feelings, affects, that's fine, that we're allowed. Since the 18th century, we're allowed to take that in. Martha Nussbaum takes them in beautifully. She's still an absolute neo-universalist and moral kind of moral universalist and classical thinker. So we have allowed certain relations to have more value. That there is a hierarchy of relations at work in our culture. And I think this shift I would like to promote with Deleuze and Guattari is to a flat ontology of multiple relations of all kinds, where actually the emotions, the feelings, would not be particularly privileged. And I think that this kind of rhetoric of feelings has to be looked at, again, very carefully. And instead of sentiments, feelings, and emotions, I would like to look at affects. I thought that what Donna read was deeply affecting and affective, and it was all the more so that as the center of it was not really the self. The center, it was a set of relations, wheelchairs, crutches, sports, the history of medicine and sports and race relations and working class literacy in the Rocky Mountains, and if you know what that is like, go and have a look. You Londoners, there's something
flat.
something that opens up to other than itself, and I think that shift, opening up to other than the self, is a de-psychologization of the self. It's a de kind of sentimentalization of the self that I think Deleuze does admirably, and Foucault does not. And in spite of everything, I know that Adana can't really stand Deleuze, but I do think
it's only
very,
50 pages.
It's only, but I think that very,
but I can't stand.
You're allowed, you're allowed. I love you nonetheless. But there is a deep commitment to de-psychologizing the question of affect and the question of pain. And if you de-psychologize the question of pain, interesting things happen. You get singularities rather than selfhood, singular immanent entities out there, not selves. And that's a very major shift. But it's too boring for this time of day, so I have to keep it short.
In fact, Rosie and Donna, thank you both very much for your presentations and for the discussion. Thank you all very much for the questions. And just to remind you that we're serving drinks, and there will be a performance by DJ Halo now in the East Room on level 7. So when you leave, please move right across to the escalators, go up to level 7 and follow the signs across to the East Room. And very big thanks to conclude to all our speakers today, to Marina Warner, Patrick Hanafin, Rosie Bradotti, and Donna Haraway.